Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we demonstrate that simply everything has its own history, like imps, dents, and roads.
Or hugs, tugs, and jugs. Plugs, slugs, and fugs. There's nothing like a good fug.
No.
Not especially around Christmas time. Happy Christmas, everyone.
Happy Christmas.
We will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam? Who knew that the history of Jericho is about monasticism, women's societies, gridlock, and going underground? Like what I did there?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah,
very good. And pockets. Pockets are all about World War II, US politics, feminism, and, of course, the history of crime.
I love the history of pockets. I want to write a book about the history of pockets.
So do I.
Maybe we'll... we'll certainly get it in.
Yes.
Are we doing...
I've just written pockets for World War II.
Why? You're on it.
Yes, I'm on it. Did you know that when paratroopers came out of their planes on D-Day, their pockets split, showering the contents of their pockets all over Normandy?
It's really... Sewing up pockets is interesting.
Yes.
Anyway, we're getting a little distracted.
Lucy Lockett lost her pocket.
The man sitting opposite me is the bus conductor of Route 1066 and all that.
Love it. I love it. That's brilliant.
It's Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam, and hello, everybody. And the man sitting opposite me is the St. Nicholas of nautical knowledge. Mm. It's the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for that, James. So this is part two of our Christmas special, because we got very carried away with our part one, and it ended up being really long. We only talked about half of what we were going to talk about. So we're going to carry on.
Yes, I'm going to start, though, before, because otherwise I might forget. Since this is Christmas, and happy Christmas,
yes.
I'm not going to see you over Christmas, but I have a little gift for you to open.
Oh my God, he's bought me a present.
Live on air. Happy Christmas, Sam. He has got nothing for me. So thoughtless.
It's so big, I couldn't get it in my shed. That's the problem.
That's it.
What is this, a mouse trap? Is it a primed mouse trap?
You'll see, and you'll think, oh, how thoughtful.
It's not going to cause me pain.
It's not.
Is it the opposite of that? You look a bit hurt, actually, when you even suggest that.
No.
It is about the size of a small biscuit tin.
It's not biscuits. It's not food.
It's not biscuits, but it's, it's a couple of inches high. It's rectangular.
I think it would be meaningful when you open
it. 6 or 7 inches long. Do you have members of your family who talk you through your opening of gifts?
Yes, I also have two daughters who basically open my gifts for me.
Yeah, my two.
Daddy, could we just help you undo the sellotape?
Okay, I'm not a very good unwrapper of things.
It's almost as if you're trying to preserve.
That's very funny.
So tell them what it is and why I chose
it
for you.
Oh my God, it even smells. He has bought me some Lynx Africa body spray and body wash.
Now, this is because...
Wow. Yeah, there's a reason for this.
In our live show that we've been doing, there's a section where we talk about the history of perfume. And Sam and I have got this perfume from the Mary Celestia. And it's about 1860s. Yeah. And it's and what we do, they harvest the genetic DNA of the perfume and they've recreated it. And
so it's perfume that was found in a ship, bottle of perfume found in a shipwreck. Some very clever scientists have recreated the perfume. And we hand a bit of it around at our live show so people can smell some perfume from the 1860s.
And then one person, we asked them what it smells like. And somebody shouted out, it smells exactly like Lynx Africa. And neither of us use Lynx Africa or had any idea.
No.
Sam now has Lynx Africa.
I do.
So does it smell like the perfume?
No.
No.
I think
I think that it was a joke that they were making.
It was a joke making, but it's nice to know what Lynx Africa actually smells like. And
yes.
It doesn't smell like a beautifully handcrafted perfume from the 1860s.
No. Well, in the morning, should you ever use that? You'll know exactly what it smells like. So Christmas, where are we going with Christmas?
I think we should offer it as a prize.
We should definitely offer it as a prize. Christmas for me is all about food.
Yes.
And I said last time that I tried to order my Christmas turkey in September, which was slightly too early. Although I have ordered the most brilliant Christmas turkey, which is deboned and then stuffed. And then with lattice work of bacon all around. Amazing. Darts Farm Butchery. Brilliant. I've also made my Christmas cake.
Yeah.
Mary Berry's apricot Christmas cake.
So last year we fed your Christmas cake.
Last year or the year before we fed it. I didn't bring it along this time.
Okay.
I'm a bit disappointed in it. I've taken pictures of it. It's not my usual Delia Smith trusty Christmas cake. So I'm experimenting this year. But Christmas is all about food. And it's all about the history of carrots.
Mm.
And this relates to some work that I've been doing on the history of carrots for World War II.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you've got rationing and you can't get fats and lard and you can't get hold of all the ingredients that go into a cake, primarily sugar? Well, instead, a cake or a Christmas pudding. During the war, you have to be very handy and use what is being grown.
Yep.
Carrots. And carrots were, vegetables were never rationed during the war, while other things like all the things that I was talking about and jam and meat were all rationed. But there was this great big push for dig for victory. So everyone sort of turned over their gardens and all sorts of space and parks and golf courses were all turned over to helping out the war effort. And carrots were one of the sort of staple commodities that they encouraged people to grow. And Dr. Carrot was a cartoon character who carried a vitamin A labeled suitcase.
Yeah.
And he was one of the characters that was used to try and tell people about the healthy benefits of carrots. What happened was that by 1943, they had a surplus of 100,000 tons of carrots.
Hmm.
And they produced a little cookbook for carrots, a leaflet number 4. It's the Ministry of Food Cookery Leaflet number 4, which is dedicated entirely to carrots. And you have recipes for raw carrots, even thrifty recipes for a carrot cap salad, steamed carrots, boiled carrots, braised carrots, carrots and sprouts, carrots and peas, carrots baked round the joint, carrot soup, and...
These are just ways of cooking them rather than recipes.
Them. Curried carrots, carrot croquettes, carrot savoury, which is carrots, margarine and flour, and the wonderfully titled War and Peace Pudding.
War and Peace Pudding?
War and Peace Pudding. And this would have been cooked in wartime. It was made in Canada during the First World War, and since then many people haven't bothered with it. But I'm just going to read you the recipe. Mix together 1 cupful of flour, 1 cupful of breadcrumbs, 1/2 cupful of suet, you need to save that, 1/2 cupful of mixed dried fruit, and if you like, a tablespoon of mixed sweet spice. Then add, and here's the important thing, 1 cupful of grated raw potato, 1 cupful of grated raw carrot, and finally, 1 level teaspoon of bicarbonate of soda dissolved in 2 teaspoons of hot water. Mix all together, turn into a well-greased pudding bowl, and the bowl should not be more than 2/3 full. Boil or steam for at least 2 hours. Nothing says Christmas like carrot pud.
And that's what you'd have at Christmas?
Yes. Hmm. Yes, War and Peace pudding. So this is a recipe for a Christmas pudding that would have been made during wartime.
Wow.
Eat your heart out, Heston Blumenthal.
Cup of raw potato.
Yes, with your dissolving orange stuck in your middle of your pudding. I had one of those 1 year and it didn't work.
Ooh.
I took it back to Waitrose and they're such nice people at the local Waitrose. They just gave me another pudding.
Hmm, that's nice.
Very kind.
Christmas is a time for returns, isn't
it? Yes, it is. Yes. What have you got for us about Christmas?
I've got the Holocaust guilt, shame and denial.
Oh, Sam. That's lovely.
Isn't it?
It's lovely. I'll then read you something nice to put you back in the Christmas spirit.
It's my Christmas gift to you, James. I consciously chose to talk about this because it is not a obviously joyous Christmas theme, but it's very, very important. And it's something I came across when I was writing for our little book, Histories of the Unexpected, for World War II, which we've nearly finished. And I wrote a chapter on rubble.
Mm.
Now,
I haven't read that one yet.
Oh, it's really, really, really interesting.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. There are two aspects of the history of rubble, which one of them we can't really talk about because it's not that Christmassy, but there were rubble women. You know, you talk about puzzle women. Yeah, there were rubble women who cleared the German streets of rubble. It's really, really important. But there were also rubble films.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
So
Rubble films. So these were films that were made just immediately after, really early on after the war, 1946. And they were set in the ruins of German cities. And it was part of a drive to regenerate the very high-quality German film industry. Now, the films that were made were controlled or censored by the Allies who were in control of that part, whether it was the Russians east or Americans and the French particularly, in West Berlin. So they were in control of the types of films that the Germans were allowed to make, but they were all set in rubble. And they were not allowed to include any sense of militarism or national pride. And they had to directly address the gravity of the nation's mistakes, not just during the war, but during the entire 12 years of Nazi rule. One of the earliest and most important was released in October 1946, and it's called The Murderers Are Among Us. And it explores lots of really important themes that Berliners were experiencing after the war. So one of the themes that they explore, which actually has got a Christmas link, is the idea of home and ownership and where you feel at home, coming back to home. And it's the story of a woman who comes back to Berlin after the war, and she walks through the rubble streets of Berlin. She goes up to her flat, and she meets the optician who lives downstairs, and he survived the war, and they say hello, and it's a sort of a wonderful reuniting. And she goes back up to her flat, but there's someone in her flat. And Ooh. Property theft and squatting was a massive problem after the war. So people didn't know who had survived, who had died, what the situation is. So there's a very hostile, unpleasant guy living in her flat.
A squatter.
He says it's his flat. She says, actually, it's mine. I've got all the paperwork. And he looks out the window with her and points at the wilderness of Berlin. He said, all of these people had bits of paper too, but they don't anymore. Very, very sinister. He refuses to leave. So they end up sharing the flat and they actually get to know each other. Lots of kind of confrontations between them to do with decoration, to do with memory, to do with how things were before the war. This does come round to Christmas in a minute. It is fascinating. But one of the most important bits is where they put the Christmas tree.
Okay. Oh, love that
There's
link.
This moment when they get a Christmas tree and they discuss where it's going to go. And the lady sets it up and then the man stops. He goes pale, becomes very aggressive and hostile. And she's just put a small Christmas tree on the chest of drawers. And he says to her, is that going to stay in this room? And she says, yes, of course it is. I've got lots of happy memories attached to the Christmas tree of my family's before the war. It's actually one of the most important parts of her Christmas, of her year. Mm. And it actually profoundly brings her back to this happy moment before the war. He, in a very cynical voice, says that that only works if the tree creates the right mood. So he's obviously got memories linked with Christmas, which are not good. And what happens is that through a series of flashbacks, they explore what's happened to him. Mm. And it turns out that he was fighting in Russia. And on Christmas Eve, previous 2 years, he witnessed a war crime where his captain above him murdered a village full of Russians. And he tries to argue his captain out of the war crime, out of the execution, on the basis that it's Christmas Eve. The captain refuses to accept that, and he tells the doctor, this guy called Mertens, to just decorate the Christmas tree in the army barracks in which they're in. So this soldier is decorating the Christmas tree while outside the window you see mass slaughter going on out through the window. And as Mertens realizes that the guns are going off and he hears the slaughter, he drops the star that he's decorating the top of the Christmas tree with, and it falls in the snow and it's trodden on. And then it gradually unfurls, and it's the Star of David. And there's this moment. So actually, he's decorating the top of the Christmas tree with the Star of David, and then there's mass slaughter going on outside. And so it's a scene that unpicks the Holocaust. It's a scene that unpicks the guilt and the shame involved with war crimes, and also very cleverly links it all back to the themes of what's going on in Berlin after the war, and memories associated with pre-war and Christmas. It's unbelievably clever.
That's incredibly powerful.
It is, and it really kind of highlights the complexities of Christmas across the ages and in different locations as well, and what Christmas and what memory, it's all so linked with history, can actually mean for people. It's very powerful, very dangerous.
Yeah. So I want to go somewhere else with this. And in our previous episode, we talked about fires and fire not being taken in and out of the house because it was bad luck.
Yeah.
Which brings me to the theme of superstition and Christmas. And you wouldn't believe the kinds of superstitions that people had, particularly on Christmas Eve.
Mm.
And Christmas Eve was a time for love divination. So the idea that you would be able to predict who you were going to marry in the forthcoming year.
I love that. So it's like a chink in the light of time.
It is.
So do you see what I mean?
It's a chink in the light of time.
So not a chink in the, what am I trying to say? Not light, the sort of the ladder of time.
Yes.
The process. So actually you can, at Christmas Eve, it allows
you're able to
look forward or back.
Yes. And you know why? It's because the spirits and the witches are powerless on Christmas
they're
Eve.
Powerless.
Powerless.
That's interesting.
So you're able to sort of dabble in those areas, the sort of superstitious areas, safely.
Is that what Scrooge does?
Without things going wrong. I imagine that's what he does.
Exactly what he does. Because there's this bit where he looks out of the window and the streets are full of
spirits.
Full of spirits, aren't they? All sort of moving around and sort of going along. We talked about Christmas Carol in part one of this. So if you want to hear what we're talking about, go back to that. So the spirits are powerless. I love that.
So love divination. And there's a story recorded by one of those folklorists I was telling you about. Records this from Derbyshire in the 1890s. And it says that if a girl walk backwards to a pear tree on Christmas Eve and walk round the tree three times, she will see an image of her future husband.
Wow.
So it's this idea. Do you remember when we talked about Halloween and we talked about the scuttle that was put on the fire with jumping nuts?
Yes.
It's another sort of tradition that's associated with working out who you were going to marry.
I love that. You should do the history of walking backwards. Is that even... Can we do that? Let's challenge ourselves.
That's a very good one.
Is that a thing?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think you could walk backwards in all sorts of ways. Backwardness.
Walking backwards. I'm going to note down walking, particularly walking backwards, I think. Here we are. I'll type that up. Very good.
Excellent. I have another superstition for you, which is related to Christmas cards.
Okay.
Those of you who are sitting looking at your mantelpiece or your houses, wherever you put your Christmas cards, have a look at the Robin Christmas cards. We all love a Robin on a Christmas card, but did you know that they're in fact bad luck?
Hmm.
Superstition says that if a wild bird enters one's house, it spells death for someone in the family. And this extends to not only wallpaper, crockery, but also Christmas cards. And there again, there's one of my folklorists, 1955, recorded in Gloucestershire. A young woman told me it was a death sign to receive a Christmas card with a robin on it. This saying dashed me considerably at the time, as I had just had cards with robins printed. However, I sent them out in spite of the warning, and I'm happy to say that there was no undue mortality amongst friends that year.
Hmm.
Isn't that incredible? Do you have any Christmas robins around? Robins on the tree?
Yes, we certainly used to have one. We used to have a little clippy kind of Victorian one. I think my mum and dad have still
got
it.
We've got tons. I might take them down this year.
Do you know what? The more I think about Christmas, the more you sort of take the lid off it. It's full of some crazy, crazy stuff.
It's full of weird stuff. Decorations.
Yeah.
You've already got your tree up.
Yeah.
And we're recording this on the 6th of December.
Yeah.
Your tree is already up. We're not allowed to have a tree up. My youngest daughter, who's a very formidable young woman, will not let us have Christmas decorations up until after her birthday, which is on the 7th of December. Otherwise, I would have it up on, last week in November.
Yeah, but I mean, so It used to be a Christmas Eve thing.
So it used to be a Christmas Eve thing and used to extend to Candlemas, which is the 2nd of February. So you would keep your you'd put your decorations up on Christmas Eve very late. So there'd be a sort of hurry to do that. But then you would leave them up for the entirety of January. And now the tradition is that you leave them up until Twelfth Night.
Yeah, yeah.
So although a lot of people feel that after New Year is over, that it's a little bit sort of tired and sad to have things up.
But before it's all to do with the darkest time of year. That's why it would have gone on for so long.
Yes.
But also when you talk about Christmas trees, it's all kind of, it was all upper class families. There's a social class thing to it. And I happen to know, because I've been reading A Christmas Carol recently for part one of this podcast, that there are no Christmas trees in Christmas Carol. 1840s. 1843. It was too early. So the Christmas tree is a surprisingly modern invention. It really is surprisingly modern invention.
Mm. Holly.
Holly, yeah.
Superstition associated with holly. There are two superstitions here. One is of the type of holly that you bring in. It's prickly holly and smooth holly. The prickly holly is male and the smooth holly is female. Dependent on which type of holly you bring in first, that is going to be the person who is the master of the house for the rest of the year.
Really?
So if you bring spiky male holly in first, it means it's going to be a patriarchy. If you bring in smooth female holly, it's going to be a matriarchy.
It's a nest of vipers, Christmas.
And then
you can get everything wrong.
Then you need to burn holly. In fact, we were on the Kerry White show, BBC Radio Devon, a week ago, and she had a listener who phoned in saying that she had holly with berries on it, and it needed to be burnt when it was taken out. And that's a tradition as well.
Yeah. Well.
Goodness me.
I mean, I think we could do an actual dedicated podcast of the unexpected history of Christmas and just keep going on.
I think we could.
So where have we gone? We've gone...
I want to read us some Laurie Lee.
Oh, you've got some more.
Am I allowed to read us a little bit of Laurie Lee?
Yes,
of course. Sort of get us in the festive season. This is about putting up decorations around the time. This is from a brilliant collection that came out recently, A Village Christmas and Other Notes on the English Year, which was sort of collecting together some of his sort of seasonal writings, and this beautiful edition that came out. Christmas in the country meant feasts and fires, a few brief days of excess, when even the poorest amongst us would confront the stern gods of winter and the bravest possible show of good living. Everybody was busy this morning, chopping wood, carrying in logs, or sitting on the doorstep plucking ducks or geese. Now the time had come for us to go to the woods and collect leaves for decorating the house. This is Christmas Eve. Among the black and bare fir trees, we shook the snow from the undergrowth with frost-reddened fingers, seeking the sharp-spiked holly, bunches of laurel and ivy, cold clusters of moon-pale mistletoe. With these, our sisters transformed the familiar kitchen into a grotto of shining leaves, an enchanted bower woven from twigs and branches sprinkled with scarlet berries. After tea, as darkness fell, we put on our coats and scarves and trooped off with Mother to the town several miles down the wind-whipped valley. We always left the buying of our presents to this 11th hour as part of the season's dramatic crescendo, joining the rest of our neighbours who were all now heading from the shops to catch the last glitter of Christmas Eve. So that captures it. The sort of early 20th century Christmas that everything was done on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
Interesting there, the sort of gender distinctions as well. It's the sisters that do all the decoration inside and the boys that go out and get all the
goodies, the holly and the logs
and everything. So where have we gone?
Where have we? Gosh, golly, we've gone everywhere all over again, haven't we? Carrots.
Carrots.
We did carrots. And we did Dig for Victory.
We did Darkness.
Did a bit of Darkness.
Rubble.
Rubble.
Christmas Carol again.
Yeah, a bit of Holocaust.
Lynx Africa.
Lynx Africa.
We did Lynx Africa.
And ending with Laurie Lee and Back to Christmas Trees. So
Lynx Africa, Lynx us, makes me think about what we're doing in the new year. And we are doing more histories of the unexpected live, aren't we?
We are.
And in particular, we are at the upstairs at the Gatehouse in Highgate on the 2nd and 3rd of February. We're doing an evening show on the Saturday night and we're doing a matinee at 4 o'clock on the Sunday. So you should come along and see us if you live in the capital city of London town.
Yeah, or not, you just come up and see us. We've got a special offer for living history people. If you were a living history reenactor, and if you come along to one of our shows in your full regalia and kit, then we will give you a discounted ticket. You get an invite to a social meetup after the show where you'll get a free drink and you get a chance to win a prize. We want to see as many of you living history people there as possible. We think it's absolutely fantastic what you do.
Brilliant.
Now, if you like what you hear, please do leave us a review on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast and tell all your friends. We're on Twitter. You can follow me at Dr. Sam Willis.
And you can follow me at James Daybell. And you can follow Histories of the Unexpected on at Unexpected Pod. We are proud to be part of the excellent History Hit Network, home of Dan Snow's History Hit and a slew of other great shows.
You can find out more about what we've got planned with our books and our live shows and everything on historiesoftheunexpected.com. Thank you very, very much for listening.
Thank you very, very much. And wherever you are, I hope you are having a wonderful Christmas.
Bye.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.